Hey photographers, I have a special announcement to make about a special sale coming up. It's actually an event. If you want to get a lifetime worth of photography business and marketing education at an amazing price, then I have to tell you about what's probably the biggest business photography bundle sale of the year. It's called the Complete Photography Business Bundle for 2016. It only lasts 5 days, and it's coming up February 25th, 2016. Now, this bundle will help you build a photography business that fits the lifestyle that you want. It'll be insanely useful for growing your business. Whether you're just starting out, trying to learn how to make money off of your craft, or even if you're an experienced professional photographer. As I mentioned, this bundle will be at an absolutely crazy discount. Dozens of top-notch photographers in the industry have contributed to this bundle specifically, so it's at a way better deal than I could ever offer on my own. When I first saw the discount they were planning on offering, I could not believe it. Not only will this be the biggest photography discount you've seen, but this bundle also has one of the largest impacts on charity that I've ever seen. The folks who put on this deal regularly raise 6 figures for charity every year, such as the Exodus Road Organization, which helps free modern-day slaves. And then there's also the Mercy Ships Organization, which helps provide life-saving surgeries for people who live in areas where medical care is nearly non-existent. Yes, that means you would be making a difference. As I mentioned, starting February 25th, this bundle will be live for only 5 days. Then they shut it down. Seriously. After 5 days, this particular bundle with this mix of products will no longer be available. So I'm sworn to secrecy about what's in the bundle, as well as the price of the bundle, until February 25th, the day it launches. So yeah, this is killing me right now. However, if you would like a reminder on the day of launch, February 25th, along with further details about what is specifically in the bundle, then head on over to photobundleforcharity.com and sign up. It's a quick page I set up with an easy-to-remember URL for those who are interested and want to learn more. You won't be actually purchasing anything. You'll just be signing up for a reminder so that this temporary deal doesn't come and go without you knowing about it. This page will also have the photos of the photographers who contributed to this bundle, a number of whom you will recognize, and a number of them I've even had on this podcast. I also include information about the charities that are being benefited. I'll also throw in an awesome bonus for those who end up signing up for the bundle. Full disclosure, I am an affiliate for this bundle, which means I get compensated for every sale made through my affiliate links. I am proud to help further such a great cause, and I'm also proud to help other photographers establish and further their photography businesses. This bundle also helps me support this podcast. So again, that URL is photobundleforcharity.com. Last thing, I know this is a time-sensitive offer that I'm announcing on an evergreen podcast, so if you're hearing this announcement after the event is already over, head on over to photobundleforcharity.com anyway. I'll include a sign-up form so that you can be notified of future photography bundles, although like I said, this particular bundle will never be offered again. So one more time, that's photobundleforcharity.com. All right, let's get to our episode. This is Shamira Young, bringing you the Pro Photographer Journey Podcast. Listen in as award-winning photographers discuss how they find opportunities, market their talent, and overcome mistakes to become respected, ever-advancing professional creatives. You'll also hear about their hard-learned lessons, as well as tips for making awesome images. You ready to take your photography business to the next level? Let's do it. Hey everybody, I'm here with Bob Christ. Bob is a freelance travel photographer who regularly works on assignment for National Geographic Traveler, Smithsonian, and Islands. He's been to all 7 continents and has won awards in Pictures of the Year, Communication Arts, and World Press Photo Competitions. He's won the title of Travel Photographer of the Year from the Society of American Travel Writers in 1994, 2007, and 2008. Bob, I could go on, but I'm going to take a pause here. We're so happy to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
And you know, I'm so pumped for this conversation because I know that our listening audience, as well as myself, certainly myself, we can all learn from your experience. So the first thing I like to do, just so that our audience can get familiar with you, give us an overview of yourself and your background.
Well, I have been a professional photographer since 1976. Mm-hmm. I didn't start out to be in photography. My first love was the theater and acting. And when I got out of college, I used to, photography was a hobby. And I worked at the school newspaper and the college newspaper. But my first love was the theater. And I actually bought my first real camera when I got a job to tour Europe with a theater company. And I figured I was saving up for a stereo. And I figured a good camera would be a better buy. So I lived overseas. I dropped out of college and went overseas and lived in Amsterdam. And we toured Europe for a couple of years, and that's when I really started taking pictures in earnest. One of the other actors in the company was a very good photographer, and acting is night work, so we used to spend our days wandering around Paris and Amsterdam and Vienna taking pictures. When I got back, I finished up my bachelor's degree, and then I kicked around in regional theater for a few years, always doing photography on the side, headshots, production stills. And I worked in California at the Berkeley Stage Company, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, People's Light and Theater Company in Philly. And then during one of the recessions in 76, we lost our funding. I was broke. I was really up against it. And I had to actually move home and live above my parents' garage. And the guy that grew up next door to me was a newspaper reporter for a paper that we both used to deliver when we were kids. And he said, you know, we're looking for photographers. And I said, well, I've never done any news photography. And he said, yeah, but it pays $140 a week. And I said, every week? Whoa, that's... So I was so desperate, I put on the only suit and tie I owned, and I went down to Union City, New Jersey with my pictures of Europe and pretty actresses and stuff. And the guy, the editor, gave me a tryout, a three-week tryout, because I was the best-dressed job applicant who had come through. The least qualified, but the best-dressed.
Wow.
University of Missouri photojournalism graduates were coming in fatigues and photo vests, and I came in looking like a traveling salesman. He gave me the tryout. I had the most unbelievable luck the first 3 weeks. Things were happening in front of my camera, that you couldn't believe, that were great news photographs. And so after 3 weeks, you know, the editor was pretty convinced that I really didn't know what I was doing, but I was kind of an idiot savant when it came to spot news photography. So he gave me the job, and I was only going to stay at the job long enough to pay off my MasterCard bill. But I ended up kind of getting hooked on telling people's stories. At first, I was going out kind of looking at these stories and the characters as character studies as an actor. And then as a visual communicator, I began to get interested in their stories. So I ended up staying at the paper for about 5 years. But, you know, after you've seen Paris, you know, how are you going to keep the boy down on the farm? And I had traveled and I had lived abroad, and I knew that I wanted to, you know, I had developed my visual storytelling chops, you know, on the streets of Jersey City and Union City, and I knew I was ready for something different. So in those days, if you were an award-winning newspaper photographer, you could get an audience with the director of photography of National Geographic.
Wow.
So I was Northeast News Photographer of the Year or whatever the title was, and I got an appointment, and I went down there. And he basically tore me apart. I mean, he just tore the work apart. But he said, look, I do have a story here that I can't give away. So I'll give you a chance on this one, see how you do. And it was a story to shoot my home state of New Jersey. And I survived that assignment by the skin of my teeth. And that began my career at the Geographic and my career in travel and magazine photography.
Wow. You know, one thing I like about your story is that it really humanizes you, because reading about your accolades on your website, it's like, man, this guy has done, it sounds like, just about everything as far as accomplishments. But hearing your story, you started somewhere, just like all of us, how we all start somewhere.
Oh, yeah. And I started by the seat of my pants, not knowing anything. In fact, I almost, when I look back at it, I'm glad I was ignorant about the odds I was trying to overcome. because if I had really realized what I was trying to do, I probably would have got scared and backed away. So sometimes ignorance can be helpful, you know?
You know, you're not the first person to say that on this podcast, actually.
Ah, okay.
Very true. And so tell us, what area of photography would you call your expertise today? Or what type of work do you find yourself most involved in?
Well, over the years, I've done a lot of things. I've done everything from freelance news photography. For a while there, I did a lot of corporate annual reports, corporate photography. But I settled into a niche of travel in probably in the mid-80s. And that's what I'm best known for, largely because I started writing about photography. When I was working for Travel and Leisure in the mid-80s, they had a photography column, and I was in the office one day, and the editor and the then photo columnist were having this huge argument, and the columnist stomped out, and the editor walked past the photo editor's little cubbyhole, and there I was, and he said, "Didn't you tell me you were an English major and you could write?" And I said, "Yeah, I can write." And he said, "You want to write a column?" And I said, "Sure, I'll give it a try." And then I became the columnist for Travel and Leisure. And up until this year, I've had a photo column in one or another major magazine. I went from Travel and Leisure to National Geographic Traveler to Popular Photography to Outdoor Photographer. I've been writing how-to about travel photography continuously from 1986 to just this year. I just resigned from Outdoor Photographer with the new owners. I've done enough writing about it. So writing about travel photography made me de facto an expert in it. And that's what I got most of my, that's I guess the label you would put on me.
Excellent. Is that your favorite genre?
I love to be dropped behind the lines of another culture for a few weeks or a few months, even better, and to tell the stories of that culture. Lately, because of the kind of decline of print and everything, and because 4 or 5 years ago, still camera manufacturers started putting video capabilities in their camera, I completely by accident got hooked on shooting video. And so I find myself now at the age of 63, kind of learning a new form of visual communication that I am totally jazzed about, because I think it offers an even more immediate and complete experience of a place that you can share with a viewer. So, yeah, it's my favorite, and I love telling stories. I've always shot for story, and now the new video kind of platform I find is amazing. But, you know, it was really a matter of an old dog learning new tricks. There's a lot of things that apply from still photography, but there's a lot of things I had to learn, and I've been knocking at it for about 5 years now, and I'm really starting to feel like I'm getting a bit of a handle on it.
That is awesome. You know, it's like we never stop learning, and you know, one thing often feeds into the next, especially with photography and video. They're definitely linked together.
Oh yeah, joined at the hip. And, you know, I found that working as a magazine photographer, as opposed to, let's say, an advertising photographer or a portrait photographer, we always were trained to shoot for story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down at the Geographic, they used to say that a National Geographic story was essentially the lead picture from a series of smaller photo essays. And that's true. You cover things in story terms. So the jump for me to video was not that hard, because in video, you have to think story too.
Exactly, definitely. And that's actually a great segue into my next question for you. I'm curious about your answer, especially with your travel and video experience. In your opinion, tell us, what makes a good photo stand out from an average photo?
Well, back in the early 90s, I wrote a book called Spirit of Place, in which I tried to answer this question. And the best I could come up with, you know, to break it down to analysis, is that for me, a good photo has to have three elements. It has to have great light, great composition, and the most important, a sense of moment. As a still photographer, we're slicing off a little slice of time, and we're holding it up and we're saying, "Hey, look at this." And if you're going to do that, there has to be something special happening in that moment. So those three elements, color composition or light composition and moment, are my mantra for a great picture. Now, it's real easy to say those three elements in a sentence. It's really hard to get them in a photograph. So I say 2 out of 3 isn't bad. And, you know, that's you'll probably end up keeping that in a take. But the real portfolio pieces have all three of those elements going for you.
And so when you say moment, are you referring to the story behind the photo?
No, I'm kind of. I'm talking about that moment that is the quintessential encapsulation of the scene. So in a portrait, every situation has a moment. In a portrait, it might be a gesture or a facial expression. In sports, it's a peak moment of action. In a street scene in a foreign country, it might be, you know, a vendor passing over some steaming food to a buyer in a market. But there has to be something going on in that still shot that you've frozen for it to be a moment. The great French photojournalist Henri Cartier-Bresson called it the decisive moment. It's that moment in any action that is the peak moment, the peak expression. A moment can be in a landscape photography, a driving snowstorm or pouring rain, something that says, whoa, you should have been here when this happened, you know? So a moment in landscape photography can be some special kind of light condition. You know, one of the reasons that we go out early in the morning and late in the afternoon to shoot landscapes is we want that special quality of light. A moment can be a rainbow coming into a landscape. So we talk about it, I guess, traditionally, it's best known in photography as the decisive moment. And that term was coined by Cartier-Bresson.
Excellent. The decisive moment, the quintessential encapsulation. Well said. And I think out of everyone that I've interviewed for this podcast, you're probably the first person that's written a book on this particular question.
Well, the book was allegedly about travel photography, and a lot of it is about travel photography. But as part of that, I did try to break down what makes a good picture. We know what we like when we see it. It's kind of like that famous definition of pornography that was given by the Supreme Court justice, who said, "Well, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it." And the same is true for photographer or for viewers looking at a photograph. They may not know why they like it, but generally, it's got to have some special light, some great composition, and a moment. And so I just went back through all my photos and all the photos that I love from my fellow photographers and the mentors I had, and I kind of analyzed them. And those were the three elements present in every one of my favorite shots of mine and almost everybody else that I admire.
Excellent. And I think it's especially important to know what makes a good photo stand out, because we're flooded with images on a daily basis, just the amount of images that we see every day.
Yeah.
It can be easy to take it all in and not put a whole lot of thought into why you like it. You know,
all of
us, we know it when we see it. But as photographers, I think it's part of our job, our duty to be able to articulate why we like it so that we can incorporate it into our own photography.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, next I'd like to ask, now I don't like to linger too much on the tools of the trade, the typical go-to gear that you like to use, just because I think putting too much importance on your equipment is kind of a little bit off base.
Right.
Because there's so much more that goes into it. But I am curious, briefly, could you tell us what your typical go-to gear is?
Well, For many, many years, for many decades, I was a DSLR shooter. I shot Nikon equipment. And about 4 or 5 years ago, when I started getting interested in video, I also started getting interested in carrying smaller, lighter cameras. I like to joke that the older and heavier I get, the smaller and lighter I want my cameras to be. Because mobility is really important when you're a travel photographer. People go out loaded with gear, and you really don't need the gear, you need the mobility. So I started picked up a Sony mirrorless camera on the side to shoot some video, because it had 60 frames per second, and nothing that Nikon made had that at the time. And then I liked it so much, I picked up a couple of lenses, and I realized after a couple of years that I had de facto switched over to Sony mirrorless cameras. So right now, a typical outfit that I might carry on a travel assignment, keeping in mind that I'm shooting a lot of video, I'll take maybe an RX10 body, Sony RX10 body. That's the it's the little camera that has a 1-inch chip with the Zeiss. It's equivalent of a 24-200 2.8. It's a fantastic little camera. Mm-hmm. And then for low light and for ultra wide, I'll carry probably an Sony A7 R2 with a couple of lenses, a 10-18 ultra wide, a 16-70 zoom, and a couple of fast primes, maybe a 35 and a 85 or something like that. And I find with those two bodies, I can shoot entire assignments, and I like, and it's light. It's half of the weight that I used to carry.
Wow, very nice. And what's your favorite photography accessory other than your cameras? And tell us why.
Oh, man, that's hard. probably the little tabletop tripod, a little tabletop tripod that I carry in the side pocket of my my camera bag. I find that I can get away with putting a lightweight camera on a tabletop tripod and shoot in places where they don't allow tripods. Or, you know, you want to be unobtrusive. Mm-hmm. As a video stabilizer, I use it against my chest, and it's very versatile for that. I can jam it against the tree. So I would probably say right now that would be one of my favorites. But I do have a lot of little favorites, other little gizmos and gadgets. But that would probably be the favorite one. And I think especially shooting video, you need some kind of help to stabilize. Because shaky video is really not what you want. But even in my still shooting days, that little tabletop tripod saved me in so many situations.
Do you remember the name or the brand of it?
You know what? It's an off-brand that I bought in Tokyo at the famous big camera store called Yodobashi. And it's unique because it has a little clamp on it and everything. But I would say almost any of the currently available tabletop tripods will do it. I think Leitz makes a good set of legs and a ball head. Manfrotto has a couple. There's a lot of them out on the market. This particular one just has that extra clamp on it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have a brand name on it. And I have never been able to find another one. And I know I'm going to mourn when I lose it or break it because it's about 15 years old. And I was just in Tokyo last year and I went back to Yodobashi and I tore the store apart looking for it. But they were looking at it. They were saying, oh, we haven't carried this since I was a little boy.
You know? Wow.
Like that. But anyway, it's just a small little tabletop tripod.
So you're using the magical unicorn of tabletop tripods that no one else will be able to find. Yeah. Hey, photographers. I want to pause and take a quick second to tell you about the New York Institute of Photography at nyip.edu. It's an online school for students who want to learn photography from the comfort of their own home on their own time. Not only is the New York Institute of Photography the world's largest online photography school, but they've been in business for over 100 years. Yes, you heard that right, 100 years. Originally established in 1910, they got their start as a brick-and-mortar school. Fast forward to today, and the New York Institute of Photography is now an online school where you can study anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. Every student gets a personal pro photographer mentor who will review your photos and help you improve. You can choose from 9 online courses based on your skill level and area of interest. They have courses on digital photography fundamentals, wedding photography, travel photography, photojournalism, marketing, and more. To view the free course catalog and daily specials, check out the New York Institute of Photography at www.nyip.edu. Again, that's www.nyip.edu. Awesome. Well, next I'd like to really get into the nitty-gritty of the business aspect of photography and lessons that you've learned, because I think many of us have really struggled with it. I know myself, I have. There was a time years ago, and I mean, it's still a learning process for me, where I thought getting into photography, I would just be taking pictures all the time. which I've long since come to learn and realize that that's only a small portion of it. There's so much more that goes into photography when you want to make a business out of it. And so my question to you is, what have you found to be the most challenging aspect of being in business for yourself? And then part two is, how did you overcome that?
Well, you're correct in that being a professional photographer is 80% office work and marketing and 20% taking pictures. Mm-hmm. The thing that's making it really difficult now is that the nature of the business has changed so radically since when I started, that the advice that I would give to a starting photographer, even as recently as 15 years ago, is totally useless now. I mean, stock photography, through the better part of my career, was a huge money-making operation. Now you can't give it away because there's billions of free photographs out there, and some of them are pretty good and everything. So, mm-hmm. So the whole nature of freelance editorial photography, the business has changed so radically that it almost doesn't resemble anything that I faced when I came up and started freelancing. In my day, if you had a good portfolio and you were reasonably presentable and reliable, and you had a decent eye, and you knocked on enough magazine doors, and you would get magazine work, and then you'd get more magazine work, and then the outtakes from those assignments would go into your stock files, and you'd generate money that way, and then you'd resell your magazine stories to magazines overseas and make another layer of money there. That's all gone now. And one of the presentations that I give these days when I'm teaching is something called Future Shock, where I've kind of gone into this long analysis of what does it mean to be a professional photographer in the 21st century, because it's certainly very different than what it was in the 20th century. And today I think it calls upon people to be a jack of all trades, and to have, we used to rely entirely on getting paid to shoot pictures. Mm-hmm. Well, I think people these days can be professional photographers and never get paid to shoot an assignment. They have a blog or a podcast. They're affiliates with camera companies. They run photo walks and workshops. I mean, one of the explosion in digital photography has, on the one hand, taken away the market for stock photography, but on the other hand, it's made millions of new photographers who want to get instruction. So it seems to me that these days that a lot of professional photographers are educators first and not assignment shooters. Now these are broad generalities. I think, for advertising photography and fashion photography, it's still an assignment-based world. Mm-hmm. But for the general editorial photographer, I think has to be really a jack of all trades and do everything from teach workshops, sell fine art prints, become an affiliate of a camera company or an equipment manufacturer. I think these are all multiple streams of income that we have to develop, and we have to do it by, as they say, developing the brand of me. Everybody needs to kind of set themselves up as a brand and have these followers and Instagram, and it's a new world there, and in a way it's a scarier world, because the Instagram example, it's a lottery. You're on Instagram with billions of other people in the hopes that maybe you get enough followers that you get discovered, and then there's always that story about the single mother from Iceland who had never been paid to shoot a picture gets discovered on her Instagram feed and shoots a BMW advertising campaign because they loved her eye. Uh-huh. And we all hear enough success stories, mm-hmm. like that we start believing that's it, we can do that too. But it's a lottery, as opposed to the old business model where there was, right now there's one or two huge winners, and all the rest of us are down around, kind of bottom feeding. But we get inspired by those huge winners. The old business model allowed for more winners. There weren't any superstars, but there were, or there were always a couple of superstars, but there were more journeymen that could make a living. So the advice that I give to people these days is to really diversify, almost stop thinking of yourself as a photographer. You're a visual storyteller or whatever it is, because you're going to have to do, anybody who's under the age of 55 in this business and is not getting video literate is committing career suicide. You need to work up some kind of a teaching thing, a podcast like you've got, a blog, Instagram followers, this kind of thing. It's a new way of nurturing a career. It's more photographer to the general public than a business to business arrangement. The only people that I had to impress back in the day were photo editors, professional photo editors and art directors. Now I have to have a following of, 100,000 people, to get the same kind of recognition or whatever. So it's a different world in that way. But the thing remains the same, that it's a lot of business nurturing and picture taking is almost an afterthought sometimes.
You know, that's so true. That is so true. And that's actually, I'll be upfront, one of the reasons why I started the podcast. Well, one of my primary reasons was because on an instinctual gut level, I felt like taking photos was not enough. I had my clients, but I felt like there was still something missing. And since then, I've gotten into teaching and doing this podcast, which it allows me to talk to awesome people like you. And I mean that. And it's just so interesting hearing everyone's take on the industry as things are changing. Like you said, in the last 15 years, there's a huge difference. And I think that a lot of photographers who are particularly in school, say if you're studying it in high school or college, a lot of it they may not realize. I mean, everyone's on Facebook, Instagram, and whatnot. But as far as how that affects how you run your business, like you said, I think you said 80%, you're doing 80% other stuff, office work, and 20% photography. And a lot of people may not want to hear that, but it's absolutely true when you try to make a go of it for getting new assignments or just getting noticed. What have you found to be the most effective techniques for getting new assignments and even just getting noticed?
Well, again, I have to answer it in two different ways. I think in the old days, what we used to do is direct mail campaigns with postcards and stuff with our images. And we'd pick up, the kind of clients that we wanted to get. And we'd do mailings and tell them, I'd mail a postcard every 2 months with a new assignment. I still think that's probably a pretty good way. But I think the other way is to be active on social media, Facebook, Instagram. Keep that work out there. The minute you get a good assignment, or even if you don't, you give yourself an assignment, you get the work up there so people can see it. It's always a matter of promoting. Now, it's really, really hard these days because everybody's promoting. Everybody's promoting what they eat for breakfast. Everybody's promoting. I've never on Facebook, I'm amazed at how many people give blow-by-blow descriptions of their latest surgeries and stuff. It's like everybody's shoving everything out there for everybody to see. So it's really hard to get somebody's attention. But I think whether you're doing something as old-fashioned as direct mail or as cutting-edge as Instagram, the important thing is to be consistent and regular and have a regular feed going, not to, disappear for months and then come back. Back in the day in direct mail, they said that somebody would not recognize your name until it crossed their desk 6 times. Mm. So if you're going to do a postcard mailing that involves sending out 3 postcards, to people over the course of 3 months, that's not enough. So consistency, the work has to be good, obviously. The work has to be good and striking. But consistency, and I also think I see so many pictures on Facebook and whatnot where people don't bother with the caption or they're not telling the story that enhances the picture other than, I use this filter or whatever. Where were you? What's the place like? Tell a little a story about it. So you almost have to sell the picture with the caption kind of a thing. But I think that that's probably the most effective way of getting noticed. But it really requires a strategy to be out there and to be consistent.
Very true. And that consistency it's so key because it's almost a given. I mean, like you mentioned, your work has to be good. It has to be striking. But if you're not consistently putting it out there, then people are not going to see it. And I'm so glad you mentioned that people need to see you multiple times before they'll recognize you.
Yeah. And the other caution that I would give to beginning photographers looking to get recognized is be really careful about photo contests, because there's a strange thing that's happening out there. Well, it's not that strange. It's understandable. Companies are sometimes taking advantage of gullible photographers by running these photo contests. And in the fine print, it says, by entering this contest, you give us unrevocable rights to market this picture, you know, for promotion, blah, 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 blah. Basically, by entering the contest, on the off chance that you'll win, you're giving the company that's running it free use of that picture. And, you know, they're getting all this work for nothing. So I would caution anybody about entering any contest that says that by entering, you give up rights to the picture. Now, some of them say if you win, you have to let us, you know, use the picture to promote the contest. And that's one thing. That's a quid pro quo. You know, you win a prize, you give up some rights. Mm-hmm. But so many of them say by entering this contest, and it's a despicable way of taking advantage of photographers' work and getting the rights to it, you know, by feeding dreams of winning a contest and getting some recognition. You'll get far more recognition by a regular campaign on Instagram or postcards or whatever than you will by winning a photo contest, you know. So I would advise everybody to check the fine print before entering a photo contest.
Thank you for that warning. I was not aware that sometimes they get your rights in the fine print just for entering.
Just for entering. That's why some of them, actually, for a while, they were requiring model releases. And I would be out teaching a workshop or a seminar, and people would ask, well, you know, do I need model releases? Because all the contests I want to enter require model releases. And the reason that they require that is because they want to use your pictures for promotional purposes. And when you use pictures for promotion and not editorial, technically, you do need a model release.
Wow.
So, I mean, they were very brazen about it. So, yeah, be careful on those. You know, we even had down at the National Geographic, the lawyers took over with the writing of the rules, and they wrote in a pretty odious term like that. But the photographers kind of banded together and said, look, if you guys don't offer fair rules, who will, you know?
Mm.
And to their credit, they did change those rules. But be careful, because there's a lot of nonsense that goes on in the fine print.
Very true. Thank you. Thank you again. You know, I think that's something that many people learn the hard way.
Oh, yeah.
It's something that can come over time, which actually leads me to my next question. As far as lessons learned, what do you see as the most common mistakes that professional photographers are making today, be it technical or business?
I think the most common mistake that I'm seeing now is that because you can do it, there's way too much talk about, well, pixel peeping. You know, people think that viewers care about whether you have 42 megapixels or 36 megapixels. And if the lens isn't quite sharp out to the corners, it's not good for this. And I see so much emphasis on the fine technical details, and not enough about the aesthetics. So I read a lot of blogs and a lot of sites. And, you know, the common thing is, you know, a guy saying, oh, I couldn't use this lens, it's not up to my standards. And you go to his site, and it's all lens tests of doorways and telephone wires. And you're like, you know what? No matter what lens you shot that with, it's still a freaking boring picture. So I tend to think that people concentrate way too much on their equipment, saying, oh, if I had a full frame camera, I'd be a better photographer.
Mm.
If I had this, I'd be a better photographer. No. The truth of the matter is that four generations ago, even an entry level DSLR would be enough to shoot whatever you need. You know, down at the National Geographic, their digital guidelines call for 6 megapixel DSLRs. That's all they require.
Really? Wow.
Six. They have not changed that since they started. So, you know, is it good to have 42 megapixels? Yeah, you can crop into it and you can make gigantic prints. But I've sold billboards to travel companies that they've used pictures on billboards from old like Nikon D70 cameras that had six megapixels. So people are way too concerned with all these little technical details and not enough with getting out there and shooting. These guys that test the lenses and you know, and just arguing with each other. They remind me back in the medieval days, the theologians from the Catholic Church got so heady that they got into these heated arguments about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. And this was a great controversy in the Catholic Church for, you know, the vicious arguments about you're wrong. And in a way, we've entered that kind of stage with some of our digital photography experts out there who will argue, you know, compressed raw, uncompressed raw. Look, if you blow this up to 3,000%, there's a little chromatic aberration. Look up and say, you know what? This is a great picture, but the chromatic aberration, I can't use it. It won't happen. If the picture has the color, the composition, and the moment, that's the important thing. So yes, technical considerations are important, but they're not the most important. You know, it's the heart and the soul and the composition and the light of the picture. And I think because we can pixel peep with such ease and blow up everything and analyze channels and all this stuff, I think because we can do it, we tend to want to do it and think that it really matters. And after a certain, you know, minimum entry quality, it really doesn't. What matters after, you know, the picture's got to be sharp and it's got to be colorful or whatever. But after a while, it's the content and the form and the light that are much more important than whether you've got the latest or the greatest megapixel monster, you know?
Absolutely. I agree. It can be a black hole kind of that you can fall into, never ending. Oh. And I mean, since I've started teaching that stuff, I've had to kind of check myself, because when you get into the nitty gritty of it, zoom in 100%, and you know, it really, you can kind of fall into it and lose sight of the bigger picture.
Exactly. Exactly. It is. That's a good way of describing it. It can become a black hole. I mean, look, technical quality is important. I'm not saying that it isn't.
Absolutely.
But it's not the only thing. And when you read a lot of these blogs and these sites, you would think that it's the only thing. And then, you know, I always kind of, you know, chuckle when somebody says, oh, you know, I couldn't get by with this lens. I'd have to have the more expensive one because my clients are so demanding. And I go to the site and I find that the person is doing senior portraits for high schoolers. I'm saying, really? These kids, you know, they shoot everything with an iPhone. They're not going to be up there, you know, blowing it up to 100% and saying, oh, there's some color fringing, you know, in the leaf behind my portrait. I can't accept this. But, you know, whatever floats your boat. But after a while, it gets to be almost comical.
Yeah, you know, when I was shooting for a magazine that I was working for full time years ago, which was an awesome opportunity because I got to do shoots as well. It was a motorcycle magazine. I started with a very entry-level DSLR. I mean, there was no qualms at all about putting that content into the magazine.
Yeah. Oh, no. The magazine editors are focused. Their eye is on the real prize. Is it a striking photograph? Does it have great color, composition, and moment and stuff? They're not concerned with the megapixels. They really aren't.
Definitely. And I'm curious then, what's one thing you wish you knew before you went professional with your photography?
Wow. I guess I wish that I knew that it would be okay to make mistakes and that you just have to go back over and over again. And I guess I wish I really knew that it was dogged determination, almost more than talent, that really separated the great photographers from the others. I think there was a misconception in my mind when I first got in that the real pros never made mistakes, that they always knew exactly what to do at any given time. And that can be an intimidating thought to work under because, you know, especially when you're doing travel photography, you're already dropped in a strange country, in a strange land, in a strange time zone with a strange language. So you already feel disoriented. And to think that, you know, maybe your competition or your hero can be in those same conditions and know automatically what to do right from the get-go is an intimidating thought, and one that was dispelled for me the more experienced photographers I met and the more of my heroes I got to know, and to find out that they had the exact same qualms and they made the exact same mistakes that I did, and they just kept going back. You know, there's a story about one of my role models, one of my heroes was a great staff photographer at the Geographic called Jim Stanfield. He retired a couple of years ago and he's living down at the Eastern Shore. But he was legendary at the Geographic for his dogged determination. And he got an assignment to shoot a story on Istanbul, Turkey. And he got permission to go up to shoot sunrise in one of the towers of Hagia Sophia that gave a beautiful overview of the city. And he went up there for 27 sunrises in a row until he thought he had it.
Wow.
27 days in a row. And that is the kind of dogged determination. And when you look beneath the, when you get the backstory of a lot of great photographers, they work hard. They if they make a mistake, they go back again and they go back again and they go back again. So I think the thing to remember is that it's determination as much as talent that will get you through.
And you know, looking at your bio, I'd say you have quite a bit of determination yourself. It says here you've been stranded on a glacier in Iceland, nearly run down by charging bulls in southern India. I mean,
oh,
wow.
Yeah. You named the dumb travel mistake. Now, you know, and those are the kind of mistakes, lack of research and, you know, just not paying attention that, you know, can get you stranded on glaciers and chased by bulls when you should have been up on a balcony somewhere. And one of the things that the older you get, the smarter you get. Most of my most exciting stories happened earlier in my career. As you get older, you get a little smarter. Those same dumb mistakes. So all those experiences happened to me pretty early on in my career. But yeah, I mean, you got to put it out there to get some of the pictures sometimes. And until you really learn the ropes, you can do some pretty dumb things.
Absolutely. Well, tell us, Bob, is there a particular photography resource or a tool or a book or an online course that you'd like to recommend to benefit our listeners today?
For me, I think one of the finest and most insightful books about being a photographer was written by a Welsh photographer named David Hearn, H-U-R-N, and it's simply called On Being a Photographer. He worked for the great consortium known as Magnum Pictures. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard of Magnum. Mm-hmm. David Hearn's book On Being a Photographer, for me, it's just a little paperback book, and it's probably out of print. You'll probably have to find it on Amazon. It's just, for me, gives a great working philosophy and some practical tips on what it means to be a storytelling photographer. And I would say that book was probably one of the most helpful things I ever read.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm actually looking on Amazon right now. Oh, found it. So we will definitely include that in the show notes for our listeners.
Okay.
And our final question for you, but definitely one of the most important, tell us where we can find you as far as your website or any other places where you are online.
Right now, the website is bobchris.com, but most of my new work is going up on my Vimeo site, which would be www.vimeo.com/BobChrist. That's where I'm putting up all my videos. And I'll have my videos up on my website as well. I do Facebook, but believe it or not, I've yet to do Instagram. So I'm contemplating, do I need at my age to develop another outlet where, you know, and since most of what I'm doing is video, the Vimeo site is where all my most current stuff goes up.
Excellent. And, you know, don't feel bad about Instagram, because at the time of this recording, about 72 hours ago, I just became active on my Instagram account. So
so it's never too late. All right.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Bob,
thank
for just chatting with us.
My pleasure.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to that awesome interview. I just want to remind you to head on over to photobundleforcharity.com to check out more about this upcoming huge photography business sale. All right, go out there and be awesome.